Accession number 12033, Reel 2.
Reel 2.
They asked about being involved with the ambulance services, and I said that naturally, they said, would you be willing to help anybody if you saw them were injured in the street? And I said, well, naturally I would, as a human being. But my argument then was, I do not need to be a member of an organised service and wear a uniform to be able to do that. I would help anybody who was in need. And that will be my attitude. Again, we didn't make much progress with this sort of argument, but it sort of petered out. And I don't think there was anything very much more fundamental than that that was discussed at the tribunal. Well, they finished by telling me that, my vicar, who brought me over from Sheffield, told me afterwards that he was sitting in the courtroom dying to be able to say, as he did say, in point of fact, that I was a member of his church and involved with a group of young men working for the church, he was dying to say that I was going to be ordained. And I wouldn't let him, because I said, I am here to witness to my Christian faith and the way that I think it should be expressed. I am not here to ask the tribunal to let me off because I'm going to be ordained. And he sat there feeling very frustrated because I wouldn't say anything about this, and he wanted to intervene, but I said no. Anyway, at the end of the proceedings, they consulted together, and then they announced that unconditional exemption would be granted in this case, which was a great relief, obviously, because I'd been arguing that to take conditions was contrary to what my aim was. I wanted to be able to say the true way for a Christian was to declare what a Christian way was and to follow that way, not to say, well, I will accept a condition in order to be able to alleviate the challenge of conscription. That seemed to me to be diverting the thing. And looking back on it now, I think I must have been extremely arrogant in attitude and so on, but it was a very strong challenge to a young man. And one went there with the desire to witness to one's faith and not for any other desire. And I was quite flabbergasted when the written report of the tribunal came to me, and their comment was, this man is genuine, sincere, bordering on religious mania. And my own belief is that it was frustration, because I wouldn't sort of fall into line with their arguments and kept answering in this kind of way. And I think they were a bit baffled by this, and that was why they thought of religious mania, although I'm sure that there was nothing I had said which could give any credence to that. And I don't think my manner is of that nature. I'm not really a religious fanatic in a way, but that was the conclusion they came to. And it was a bit startling, so much so that, that one of the Sheffield MPs, I think his name was Wilson, Dr. Wilson, I've forgotten his Christian name now, actually asked a question in Parliament about this. I don't know what the outcome of that was, but in point of fact, some people were concerned that such a comment should have been made, which was quite gratuitous and unnecessary.
Could I ask you a little more? You know, you've read out your statement, which explains a lot, I think, about the basis of your belief. But this is a wonderful opportunity for us, you know, to talk to somebody like yourself about the sort of Christian arguments for pacifism. And, you know, I wonder if you could expand more on that, because people have said to us, you can read almost anything into the New Testament, you know, that one could interpret Christ the tiger, as it were. You know, the fact that he was violent at times in the temple and what have you. So I wonder if you could sort of explain
Yes, I don't think Jesus was violent against people in the temple. He turned over the tables of the money changers and drove out the sacrificial animals because they had abused the precincts of the Holy Temple. And particularly, what they had done was to go into the sort of right of way through the temple, leading towards what was called the Court of Gentiles, which was a symbol of the idea that the temple was there for all people to pray, not only Jews, but Gentiles. And Jesus is reported to have said, "My house of prayer, it is written, my house will be a house of prayer for all nations." And it was the abuse of this entry to the Court of Gentiles, which the Jews weren't really terribly impressed by. They were a bit exclusive, and so they blinked at the idea of people carrying on what was perfectly necessary trade. In point of fact, when people who come from different parts of the world with foreign money, they changed that foreign money into Jewish money so that they could offer it in the temple. They were the money changers, and the sacrificial animals were there as part of the worship so that people could have something to offer in sacrifice according to the Jewish ritual. So I think when people go on about profiteering and all that sort of thing, they are rather seeing more into the situation than was actually there. It was a legitimate trade which was desecrating the ideal of all nations being able to pray in God's house, in the Court of Gentiles. And that was why Jesus was angry. And he did not lash out with a rope at human beings, as El Greco's painting indicates. He took a piece of rope and just flicked the animals, which is the way that St. John reports it, and the other Gospels don't mention this incident. So that I think it's easy to sort of read into that that Jesus was a violent character or behaved violently sometimes. I don't believe that he did, certainly not against human beings. And when his disciples were wanting to rescue him, when he was eventually arrested, he refused to allow Peter to draw his sword. What that sword was, I've no idea. I can't imagine Peter going around with a sword. It was probably a kind of sharp, short knife with which he cut off the high priest's servant's ear. And Jesus rebuked Peter for that and refused to identify himself with the kind of Messiah who was a freedom fighter, that in point of fact Barabbas, who was condemned alongside Jesus, in fact was a freedom fighter, a man who was prepared to kill and to break the law in order to fight for his people and rescue them from the yoke of the hated Romans. And then the ironical choice was put by cynical Pontius Pilate to the people: which will you have, Jesus, the King of the Jews, or Barabbas? And given such a choice, people did what they would do almost any time. They chose the man of action, the man who seemed to be ready to get things done, and shouted for Barabbas. And then he said, "What shall I do with Jesus?" And then they all shouted, "Let him be crucified." We couldn't care less about him. He looked a pathetic figure at that particular time, and didn't seem to have anything to offer to the people he'd come ostensibly to save and to bring to freedom. And so in a sense, that is almost the issue of pacifism. What can the pacifist offer in a situation of threat and aggression and violence like Hitler or Saddam Hussein in more modern times? It seems almost pathetic. During this Gulf crisis, I remember seeing on the television a group protesting outside the White House in Washington. And there were some placards being held up, and one placard was held by a woman, and it said, "Love is the answer." Now, on the television screen, seeing the woman holding that little placard, it looked a little bit pathetic. It looked almost like Jesus standing in front of the crowd at Jerusalem. What will that get you, you see? Where will that get you? Barabbas is the man who will get things done. He will do something positive to try to relieve this situation. And in a sense, I was taking part in a television program quite recently in which a man called Colin Morris, it was on ITV, was arguing against pacifism and saying that he'd not been able to see a pacifist program. Well, in a way, it's a false situation. That it is almost like saying to somebody who's a Christian, what is your program for the world? Well, we don't have a program. We proclaim the truth as we believe it in Jesus Christ. And we believe that that truth is relevant to all situations. And that, in fact, the woman in the White House garden was saying a truth, although it seemed a simplistic truth. Love is the answer. It seemed after the Gulf crisis that violence was the answer, especially applied so ruthlessly and with such scientific precision, directed in such a way that it reached its target. Occasionally, of course, it reached the wrong target as the shelter with all the people in there indicates. I think they were perhaps trying to get at Saddam Hussein personally on that occasion, and they hit a whole crowd of women and children sheltering. That is the sort of thing that happens in war with violence, which is not selective. And violence was brought to its head at the end of the last great world war, when inevitably the means of destruction and scientific knowledge were concentrated in the form of creating the atomic bomb, which is totally indiscriminate and which could only be anyway effective by destroying whole areas of population, not selected targets, not a military weapon at all in that sense, but just a weapon of total destruction. And that, in a way, was a kind of terrible warning for mankind, that we must find an alternative to the use of violence in our disputes. I mean, we'll always have disputes and arguments, but mankind has to find a way that is different from violence, because violence cannot be controlled. It cannot be scientifically... We've tried to do that in the Gulf, scientifically deploy it and accurately target it. And it seemed as if that was the answer, but in the end, there is a mess, there is confusion, there is the plight of the Kurds, which can't be solved just by violence in that kind of simplistic way. There has to be another way, and mankind has to find the way. I believe that Christianity, which is prepared to accept the cost of all the evil in the world, that is the cross, that is our Christian symbol. What Jesus did, in point of fact, was simply to obey the way of God. He cried in the Garden of Gethsemane, "Let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but yours be done." And what else did he do for us except that simple act of obedience? And yet the cross has become, because the impossible happened, I mean, our Christian faith is that Jesus was buried and that he rose from the dead. A miracle happened. And we have to believe in the possibility of the impossible. And that is the kind of justification for our faith. I believe that the Anglican bishops meeting at the Lambeth Conference every 10 years, in 1930, they passed a resolution saying that war as a method of settling international disputes is incompatible with the teaching and example of our Lord Jesus Christ. They passed that in 1930. I think the phrase was taken out of the Kellogg Pact of 1929. And they have repeated that resolution every 10 years since, when the Lambeth Conference has met. Each time they have reaffirmed that same resolution. And that has been something which we in the Anglican Pacifist Fellowship have very much concentrated upon. In 1978, the bishops went even further, and they discussed the question of violence, and they came out with this resolution: Jesus, through his death and resurrection, has already overcome all evil. He made evident that self-giving love, the way of the cross, is the way to reconciliation in all relationships and conflicts. Therefore, the use of violence is ultimately contradictory to the gospel. Now, that is the basis of my pacifism, that it is contradictory to the gospel, because the gospel offers us that other way, even at the cost of apparent failure and death, as Jesus rejected by the crowds and by his own people, and eventually condemned to death by the Roman authorities, suffering a terrible death. He seemed to have achieved nothing at all. And when he died, he was buried. And that seemed to be the end of the story. Most people would think that is the end of the story as far as pacifism is concerned. But the unexpected happened. And out of that unexpected event, the cross has become a symbol of hope for the whole Christian church and maybe for all mankind. And I believe that not only Christianity, but all the world's religions have at their heart this revulsion against violence and this respect for the sanctity of human life and this honour to the power of love. You can find it in Islam. Islam means peace and surrender. And one of the occasions when I heard the most passionate speech I've ever heard in my life in favour of total, absolute non-violence was by a Muslim. It was at a conference, the World Conference on Religion and Peace, an interfaith conference which took place at Louvain in Belgium when I first joined this group in 1974. And this man was a professor of Cairo University, medical professor, a doctor, and was nearly blind. And it was the most moving thing to see him standing in the gallery and arguing that no violence at all was permissible, not any kind. He was so adamant about this. Well, he was a Muslim, so I felt there's a great deal in common there. And of course that applies naturally to the Buddhists, whose whole philosophy of religion is based upon the idea of non-violence and upon meditation and peace. And I believe that we can find the same kind of link wherever we go. So I am now working with this World Conference on Religion and Peace in a local London group of which I've been until last year the chairman. I relinquished that. And it's now taken over by Dr. Pauline Webb, the BBC broadcaster, who is, and Rabbi Albert Friedlander of Westminster Synagogue, who is a very dear friend of mine. And we have found a close identity in our love of peace together. So it is strange that one of the closest friends again within this movement should be not just a Christian, but a Jewish rabbi. And that applies. We've got people from all the faiths in our group. And I particularly remember one incident. This World Conference on Religion and Peace is international, worldwide. We had a meeting in Peking at the time when we were preparing for the United Nations second special session on disarmament. And WCRP, the World Conference on Religion and Peace, had written to all the heads of government of the nuclear weapons powers, Britain, France, America, Russia, China, to ask them to receive a deputation, an interfaith international deputation. And the only one that, in point of fact, responded was China. China invited a group to go to Peking. And I had a telephone call at 8 o'clock one morning in Crewe from a woman called Dr. Maria Luca, who was the secretary of the European Committee of the WCRP, saying to me sort of somewhat startlingly, can you go to Peking next Tuesday? Because the German representative was unable to go, and she wanted somebody to represent Europe, and asked if I could join them. And in point of fact, I found ways of getting to do it, and went. And we went into the Great Hall of the People, and we sat at a long table opposite the representatives of the Chinese government, the Chinese ambassador to the United Nations. And we gave our views about what the United Nations ought to do. we spoke quite freely, and we did as I'm doing with you now, talking about the things that we thought were important. I remember saying that meeting in the great hall of the people should remind us that we were there to speak for the ordinary people, that we should consider the implications of nuclear weapons for the ordinary people, that this terrible thing spread far beyond frontiers and was totally indiscriminate, and that we should have nothing whatever to do with it. And different faiths were speaking, including a quite prominent Muslim from Islamabad, who in point of fact was then the sort of roving ambassador for the Pakistani government, but he didn't sort of want to make that officially known in our discussions. And he was passionately arguing for peace. And I said to him, when we got back to our hotel, I said, Dr. Brohi, I said, it was very moving to me to hear you saying in the meeting this morning exactly the kind of things that out of the depth of your faith that I want to say out of the depth of my faith. And he simply put his hand on my arm and said, thank you for saying that, brother. And I felt that this was very eloquent. It spoke volumes about the fellowship that can exist between people. Islam is thought of in the popular press as being violent and bloodthirsty and so on. And we have to say, so is Christianity. The two most bloodthirsty religions in history have been Islam and Christianity. The two who ought to have been the most prominent in the proclamation of peace, surrender and forgiveness have become identified in the popular mind with that kind of thing that we can see in the Christian country of Ireland, where the most terrible things are happening, by people identified by Christian labels. I don't think they are Christians who are doing these awful things, but they are identified in the popular mind with Catholic or Protestant. It's interesting, incidentally, talking about the Catholics, that the most prominent in the world of the support for this interfaith society to work for peace has been the Roman Catholic Church. We had a meeting, a kind of assembly in Westminster Cathedral a few weeks ago when Cardinal Hume was present, when we had people of all faiths testifying to peace in their own way, in their own language. The sort of thing we do in the Interfaith Week of Prayer for World Peace, which in point of fact had been proposed at an annual meeting of the Anglican Pacifist Fellowship by a member of ours who has since died, saying, we have a week of prayer for Christian unity, why can't we have a week of prayer for peace in the world? And they decided, they thought this should be done. And then the question was, well, who's going to organise it? And I was landed with the job. And I started by going to the home of Canon Edward Carpenter, who became Dean of Westminster, and asking if we could form a group to organise this. And we called together an interdenominational and interfaith representative group of people in his house, and we formed the committee that started organising this. They gave me the job of being the organising secretary from my study in Crewe. I was still a vicar then and busy in parish life, but I somehow got this thing off the ground, and eventually we got an office in London. Now some of the work is still concentrated in this little house. Yesterday I posted to every corner of the world letters enclosing prayer leaflets for the 1991 Week of Prayer for World Peace. Incidentally, the prayer leaflet was drafted by Rabbi Albert Friedlander, and he's done it on some occasions, not all occasions, but several occasions. And one occasion, he told me he was criticised because the prayer leaflet was too Christian, which was ironic in itself. But on the other hand, last year he had drafted it, and he had an irate letter from an Anglican vicar to say there was no mention of the name of Jesus Christ, and therefore the prayer leaflet was useless and he would have nothing to do with it. And dear Albert wrote to him a lovely letter, kind and gentle, and explaining that it hadn't been his intention to miss out the name of Jesus at all, but there were various reasons why it had worked out that way. I sent a postcard from New Zealand, where we were at the time, and Albert sent me a copy of this letter. I sent him a picture postcard from Auckland, and I said, "You are the most ironical person I've ever met," to Albert. Dear Albert, as you perhaps know, he's just had a multiple heart bypass operation and is slowly recovering his health. But he's certainly a man of peace. And this week of prayer for world peace has grown from its launching in 1974, when we had a service in Westminster Abbey. And Michael Ramsay, then Archbishop of Canterbury, gave the address, very good address. And we have had a pretty strong support in the United Kingdom. I was sending out up to 100,000 copies of the prayer leaflet from either my home in Crewe or else the office that we had in London. It's now fallen off a little bit from that, but we're still sending at least 40,000 or 50,000 prayer leaflets. And also, it's been taken up in Australia, where they reprinted the leaflet and distributed 50,000, and New Zealand, where they distribute 9,000, and Japan, where, with the aid of a lay Buddhist group called Risho Kosekai, they've really taken it up, and they have translated it into Japanese and reprinted it, and they've distributed 400,000 copies last year. So that, as I say, yesterday I posted, spent £30, 52 pence on postage to every country one could think of in the world. And so all over the world there are people who are joining in this exercise of prayer. We just...